today I'm here with Tony Atwood. Tony has written the top-selling book on Asperger's syndrome, and he's basically had his name defined as being the Asperger's guy. His book has been published in tons of languages. If you do a search on Tony's name around the web, that's what you're pretty much going to find out about. So, Tony, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Adrian. I'm delighted to be able to talk.
But since you're here, actually, what I really want to ask you about firstly is, can you tell us about your photography? Because I hear you're also a photographer.
I would love to. It's really sort of I'm an artist that hasn't had an opportunity to express myself artistically. I suppose I do in passion in the work that I do. But I've always enjoyed capturing the moment. People, scenes, whatever. And if I had more time, I would do photography to a sense of, not in a professional sense, but pure enjoyment.
Very cool. That's my hobby also. I did some shooting in North Korea last year and in Haiti and a bunch of places. I very much enjoy it. But anyway, so yep. We're here to talk about you. So can you tell us a little bit about where you've come from? I know you, and I talked with Simon Baron Cohen about this last week. Both of you studied under Uta Frith in the UK. Maybe could you just tell us about what you did in the UK and sort of your background in your life and then in autism?
Okay. Well, clearly by my accent, I'm English. And so that's where I was born and brought up. Did my psychology training there and wanted to be a psychologist when I was about 14 years old. And so I knew that's the profession I wanted to go into. But didn't know which branch. But at 19, I was a volunteer at a special school and met two severely autistic children and was totally bewildered, great compassion for their problems, very difficult to understand, and that was that day when I met those two autistic children that I decided that's where I'm going to go. I'm going to one day become an expert in autism to help these children. Now, this was 40 years ago, this last July. And so that dream has come true. I am now an expert in autism and Asperger's. It's a wonderful antidote to a midlife crisis. And from that, I did my clinical training, PhD with Uta Frith, and Simon Baron Cohen was one of her students at the same time. So it's a wonderful opportunity to be there at the beginning of many of the great theories of autism. But I'm a clinician rather than an academic, and so every week I see at least 10 to 15 people with an autism spectrum disorder. And I've moved now to Australia, to Brisbane, wonderful place. Of course, Adrian, you'd know about that.
And I actually lived in Brisbane from when I was 2 until about 6 years old.
Oh, really? So you know what it's like. But at the moment, as this is being recorded, I'm in America for a series of presentations. And what I find so delightful is I'm invited all over the world to share my knowledge.
Yeah, Tony's actually a little bit of a tough guy to track down. He's in one city to the next, and we're very lucky to be getting this interview. It's very nice of you to fit this in between, because I know how it is when you're on the road.
Oh, it is, but I think this is so important because I want lots of people to know various aspects of autism and Asperger's syndrome, and this is an excellent way of passing on that information.
Well, great. So can you tell me then, firstly, what's the difference between a psychiatrist or even an academic and a psychologist and what you do?
Oh, that's a very contentious, like a civil war going on sometimes.
Okay.
A psychiatrist is someone who's done training in medicine, so they know how to diagnose appendicitis and things like that. And then they took several years to study psychiatry. A psychologist has studied psychology since undergraduate level and has specialized in various branches of that. Now, that means for a psychiatrist, it's usually medical problems, mental disorders, and so on, whereas a psychologist can be trained in a whole range of aspects, organizational psychology, sports psychology, and my area, clinical, but there's also educational. Now, an academic is a person based at a university that conducts research. I'm a clinician in the sense that I see people with autism spectrum disorders, both for diagnosis and for treatment. So we all have an important role to play, hopefully working cooperatively. Can't always guarantee that.
Right. And so at what stage, because Simon Baron Cohen is, he's a psychiatrist and then he's in the academic communities. And he's, so
he's actually a psychologist.
Oh, he is. So he's the same as you.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Right. Okay. But has he gone more towards an academic route, or are the two of you doing the same sort of thing?
Well, we're doing the same sort of thing in a way. I mean, he's not an academic that is in an ivory tower. the work that he's done has been in the areas of diagnosis and areas of really understanding the conceptualization of autism. So I think what we do is complementary.
Right, okay. And I won't ask you for any drinking stories from college that, you know, we should know about.
No, because there aren't any.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, the reason was this. I knew that I had to work in the area of autism. And to get on a clinical course, you have to work very hard. You have to be the absolute tops in the UK to get onto a clinical master's or PhD. So when I was at an undergraduate level, I had to forego not only alcohol, but girlfriends too, to really focus on the work to get onto a clinical course. So I had to be very puritanical, artificially, just to get the exam results that I needed.
It's interesting. My father's an orthopedic surgeon, and he said the same thing for going through school. Like, he had to really focus.
Yep. Unfortunately, you do, but I'm glad I've got through when I'm trying to help others. I have my proteges and so on that I'm helping through, as I was helped by people like Lorna Wing and Uta Frith years ago. So I think there's a new generation coming through. Far more people interested in autism than ever were in my day, but from my perspective, when I became interested in autism in 1971, I could read all the journal articles on autism within a month.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that today.
No, well, it's fashionable today. That's the difference. I wish I wasn't interested in it.
It's always been there. Autism spectrum disorders have been a part of human nature since humans began. But what's happened is that we're now recognizing the challenges faced by such individuals. And in many ways, we're making life more difficult for them. And hence their difficulties are becoming a more...
You know, and that's something I would absolutely agree with. At the same time, I had a very interesting interview with a researcher at Columbia University here in New York. And he said that they've got the records from all California school children born since something like 1986. And they get 500,000 kids that go through it a year. And they get a lot of data. It's all anonymized. But they get a lot of data around, and they've been doing a lot of data mining on this 8 million person data set on who is diagnosed and is on the spectrum, and then where their demographics and the kinds of things they do and stuff like that. And he said that they have, one interesting thing was he said they have a 10 to 15% that actually leave the spectrum. They call them bloomers, and they don't know why they leave, and then they don't know who they are. But their leaving means they no longer need services from the California government. And then he said that they've really gone through the data very heavily, and because I pushed him on this a bit, and I'm like, well, you know, maybe this has just always been there, and we've never found it. And he said that they've run the data a lot of different ways, and when you take into account what you would expect to have always been there, it still doesn't fit. Like, there's something like a 50% lift that they're seeing, which they haven't been able to account for. What would your thoughts be on that?
Oh, and you've made two major points there. The first one about the 10 to 15% who become what we call subclinical. And as a clinician, I would endorse that. There are those individuals I've seen that I have actually removed the diagnosis from. There was one person I saw when he was about 7. This is someone I saw recently when he was about 21. And the clinical picture has changed. And I officially crossed out the diagnosis, because if you do a diagnostic criteria on him today, he wouldn't fulfill those criteria.
So did you sit him down and say, congratulations, you no longer have Asperger syndrome?
Yes, I did. And he wants to join the police force. And I said, look, one of the problems was that there was a concern that because he had Asperger's, the police force was saying, nope, we can't have someone like that. And I was thinking, well, about 10% of the police have got to go there. But I then wrote a letter to the police department saying, you must consider this person because I've relooked at his profile of abilities. He's no longer diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. You must assess him now as any citizen applying to become a police officer.
I bet that was very powerful.
It was. He's so keen on becoming a policeman, and he'll be so good as a policeman too. So there are some, when some become some subclinical, it's a developmental disorder, not necessarily a permanent absence. So there are some that do acquire the skills later in life, but what we don't give the person credit for is the degree of intellectual effort that goes into that social success. So the person may be able to socialize as well as other people, but it may be for a duration of only 2 to 3 hours, not 8 or 9 hours. They may get what I call a social migraine. They may also have a successful career, and I think that's one of the most successful indicators of successful outcome, is a good job. But they may also have colleagues, they may also have family members, may have a partner who also provides support too. So the outcome isn't always, as it was previously thought, that this person will have a constant level of impairment in these areas.
So, you know, this is something that's very interesting to me, because in your book, you close with the story of the child who was diagnosed in the beginning, and you close with the outcome that you see at the end, where he's the kind of disabled engineer who does pretty well driving his nice car and marries the single mother with two kids, and, you know, think life's looking up for him. Would you still agree with that as a typical or great outcome, or would you change that now?
It's true. It is a possible outcome. But it illustrates a number of components within that little story, that he's found the right job in engineering, and people now appreciate him for his intelligence and problem-solving, not his ability to crack jokes. He's also found someone who's understanding of him and compassionate. And so for that individual, they're now valued by society. He values himself. He's now not only got a career, he's also got a partner. And often those with Asperger's are late developers and bloomers in terms of relationships. So he represents a possible outcome, an outcome that I would like to see become more common.
And you don't think we're going to be able to... I mean, this boy with the police force, don't you? Do you think that will be his outcome, or do you think he'll go further?
I think it will be his outcome. I think he will find possibly a woman in the police force who shares the same honesty, integrity and value systems and sense of upholding the law and social justice. And I think the two of them will probably be highly successful. But I think he's likely to find that relationship late 20s, early 30s, when he's more mature, but also women are more mature and more appreciative of the qualities of Asperger syndrome.
My feeling is that we should be able to take these guys further.
Further in what way?
I'd like to see the guy learn to dress really well, to be in really good shape. I'd like to see him go out with a cheerleader.
Indeed, that may be a possibility. There will be some guidance. I mean, in that hypothetical situation, his partner may well provide that guidance. But the thing is, it may be guidance that people haven't given that person before. Once they've got it, then they'll do it. But sometimes there can be confusion, but also what I call a fear of making a mistake and not wanting to get it wrong, that can lead that person not to try.
Right. Because there's no reason to. And, you know,
well, sometimes because there's no reason to. They may be quite happy. And when I work with those with Asperger's, I'm trying to encourage them to accept who you are, to be what I call a first-rate Aspie, not a second-rate neurotypical. So it's really be accepting on who you are. And what I say to that person is, rather than, as an adult, giving you lots of training, I would rather help you explain yourself to others so they will know why you do things that are confusing or abrasive and accept that you do that, rather than expect you to be like everyone else.
Fair enough. So what do you think about the lift in terms of diagnosis? Do you agree with that?
That's a tricky one. I mean, when we look at autism spectrum disorders, we know there are a number of factors that are associated with that. One of the ones that's becoming much clearer is in terms of it being associated with older parents, with parents in their 30s when they start having children. And of course, modern society, people are starting to consider children in their 30s when they got their qualifications and their career has started to take off. People may not realize that that tends to be associated with a greater risk of autism spectrum disorders.
So you think that would be your thoughts as to why it would be increasing?
I think that's one of the factors. I don't think there's going to be one factor. I think we've also known that there are environmental factors, and there may be particular toxins or something that occurs in utero that affects the development of the brain. So I think those sorts of things in our modern society, we may be getting more, for example, if you talk to the pediatricians, there is more diabetes amongst children, there's more asthma, more eczema, and certain developmental disorders. So there may be something that's occurring in our modern society in a toxic effect that is affecting children.
When I talked with Peter from Columbia, one of the things that was something I saw on the web as a joke a couple of weeks ago, but they were saying, did you realize that you were at one point actually inside your grandmother? And the basic point is that when your mother is born, your mother's born with all of her eggs.
Yes.
And so,
indeed, that is the case. But there's also the question that sperm takes 70 days to manufacture, and they're replicated on a regular basis. So by the time the dad is 35 plus, there's a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy, and so the genetic material then could have changed. We're also identifying new causes related to autoimmune disorders, and that's a very fascinating area, and whether the mother may have had an association with a particular autoimmune system or breakdown can be associated with autism spectrum disorders. They're doing research on that in California. So I think we're going to find there are many causes for autism spectrum disorders, not one simple one, and those factors may combine to have a slow increase rather than a dramatic increase in autism.
So a topic that I've been pretty interested in lately is mirror neurons. What are your thoughts on that?
An interesting topic, needs further research in it. In a way, the mirror neurons, it's that ability to absorb what somebody else is going through in terms of movement skills, but also in terms of emotions. And whether your own circuitry spark off at that to duplicate those feelings, those thoughts, and those actions. I think it's something that needs further research, very good conceptualization, but I'm not an expert on it.
Right. Because that would... If that turned out to be correct, that would change a lot of how we would view autism in terms of concepts like theory of mind, empathy, and everything else, that there isn't such a drastically different brain type on the autism spectrum, that in fact it could just be mirror neurons not being triggered properly, and if we were able to find a way to activate them, that maybe there would be a way to in fact lift people off the spectrum.
There may well be, and I think that's a possibility in the future, that we may look at new technology. And I suspect it may come from somewhere that we've never thought of.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody will discover it somewhere, somehow, and then there will be quite a revelation. You've got to be careful in autism, though, because there have been promises of cures for decades.
Right.
And because the person looks like any other person, the family will say, oh, if I try this new holding technique or this new injection or this new hyperbaric chamber or whatever it is, that the entrepreneur that's promising the cure, well, I'll give them thousands of dollars towards that. But we haven't found a cure.
Right. And so how does given that there's that skepticism and there's the issue with becoming the, like, Jenny McCarthy style, like, I pooped out my autism story. Like, how do new approaches get evaluated?
I think one of the problems, because you've got a new drug coming out, it's got to be assessed and approved by a panel of experts, and you've got to go through quite rigorous scientific proof with placebos, etc., before a new medication is available on prescription. However, some of the treatments can come out, and anybody can bring along something, hang him by his toenails, you know, for 10 minutes, and that'll help him. There needs to be probably an internationally recognized body that approves certain treatments, or it's approved by publications in standard journals, by evidence-based proof that you have confidence in that. And I think that's what internationally we need to do.
I'm going to be interviewing later this week Alison Singer, who runs the Autism Research Institute, and their focus is on fact and evidence-based outcomes. Have you heard of them?
Yes, and applaud what they do, because it's got to be evidence-based. It's got to be independent. And the person who designed whatever it is can't do it, because you can't be objective in that situation. What I don't want is then for there to be a delay before things are brought forward. So I think there needs to be an adequate scientific system, but one that allows people, and myself as a clinician, because parents will say to me, well, what do you think about this, or what about that? And I have to be very cautious, because I say, well, I haven't got any research evidence to confirm that. If you want to try it, then go ahead and do so, but be careful of any side effects that aren't recognized at this stage.
Hmm. Have you found anything that you seem that you think is promising?
Oh, I mean, a lot of my own work is in terms of cognitive behavior therapy for emotion management.
And just on saying that, I just have to mention that there's actually a page on Wrong Planet where someone took notes from your seminar in, I don't know, it was probably more like 4 or 5 years ago, and it's just Emotion Management by Tony Atwood. That was profoundly helpful to me, and I've been sending it to a ton of internet guys, and I'm like, look, guys, you know, like, we're all geeks and, you know, sitting at home working all the time. This is something you want to keep an eye on, because it's really, really useful. And so I've been sending it all over the place, and I'm like, nobody has autism, you know, just this is what the people who are most at risk for this sort of stress do, and it's worked for me, and so check it out. And a bunch of people are now using it, so good stuff.
Good. Oh, thanks for that. I do pass it on as much as you can. What's happened is that within autism, the autism studies and therapies are usually designed by neurotypicals. And psychotherapy is psychotherapy for neurotypicals by neurotypicals. What's interesting is that there are a number of people with Asperger's now that are going into psychology and psychiatry. And I'm hoping that they will then design psychotherapy and treatments by Aspies for Aspies. And I think this is somewhere to go in the future.
Now, because there's one book I read about empathy, and they were talking about that they should be just encouraging those with very high levels of, as Simon Baron Cohen would say, both cognitive and affective empathy. What would you say to that?
Oh, well, I'm going to give my personal, and I hope not controversial, thoughts on empathy. 2 points on that. When people look at empathy within Asperger's and say, well, the suggestion is, oh, they lack empathy. Now, that's a gross insult to people with Asperger's, you know, gross insult, because they can be some of the kindest people I know. I think what's occurring is this. The person with Asperger's is not very good at reading subtle body language. So when a neurotypical is in mild levels of distress, there's an anticipation that the person with Asperger's will respond with affection or compassion or consoling. Now, because the person with Asperger's didn't read the signals, they didn't change their behavior. And then the neurotypical projects on them, you don't care. And yet they can be the most caring of people. I think it's a question of reading the subtle signals. A second point is that there are many ways...
Well, actually, just on that first point, that could point to mirror neurons, couldn't it?
It's a possibility, yes. But okay. There's another component of it, and that is that there are many different channels to work out what someone may be thinking and feeling, but also to perceive danger. And I think some with Asperger's syndrome and autism have what I call a sixth sense for emotional atmosphere. In talking to people with Asperger's, reading the autobiographies, they will say things like, I walked into a room and sensed antagonism. I left that group because of the emotional atmosphere. So it's not necessarily a total indifference. It can actually be a sensitivity. In fact, some, and I use the metaphor, have developed behavioral characteristics like a cactus, which has a very sharp and prickly exterior to protect a soft and vulnerable interior. And so some with Asperger's, in fact, are emotionally very sensitive to emotional atmosphere, but they can't tell you how they picked up that information. But they can sense when somebody is annoyed with them, critical about them, or the atmosphere in a group. But I think they're using a different channel than the usual one of reading faces, body language, etc. If that channel doesn't work, I think humans have another channel.
Now, that's interesting. Tell me if this may not be related, but let me just ask you. I've lived in a lot of different countries around the world. Some of them considered maybe not that safe. I lived in Medellin in Colombia a couple of years after Pablo Escobar was killed. I've lived in Mexico for a while, and I spent the last decade living down in the Caribbean, because I can work online, I can live wherever I want. And my parents originally used to really worry about all of these places I'd live. And then one of their friends said, look, Adrian seems to have some sort of sense about picking up situations that can be problematic, and he stays out of them, and so it should be okay. Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Because I've never really had trouble, and I don't understand it. No, and other people seem to just stumble into things.
Yeah, well, people seem, you can't do that. You're going to be naive, etc. No, there is a sixth sense coming up here that person with Asperger's has that ability to perceive danger and back off and be successful. So when you did your original question about empathy, I wanted to clarify that, because otherwise neurotypicals will say, oh, you don't care. You can't perceive. And I would say that's not true.
Maybe that sixth sense somehow develops through being in threatening situations, and we get that in an extra radar or something, that we somehow pick up on things.
Yes, but I think it's sort of built in. I think there's a lot of redundancy in the human neurological system, and so there are many systems that you can use to pick that up. Animals will do this, and they can be in a field, and they just sense that there's a tiger creeping up on them, and off they go. So I think this is a survival instinct, and that those with Asperger's can be tuned into their senses, their auditory sensitivity, their olfactory sensitivity, and I think sometimes they can be tuned into a sixth sense.
That's very interesting. I learn interesting things talking with you guys that I don't expect. One of the things that I found very interesting from your books, and it left me thinking about it for a long time, and I've now come to the conclusion that I don't agree with it, but it's still a very helpful tool, and that is the emotion thermometer.
Okay. Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I'm like, oh, well, you know, my emotions are like screwed up, and my emotional range, like, I can't feel my emotions properly, and so the only way that I can understand where my emotions are at is if I cognitively sense them, and that's, you know, that's how it is. So I can't sense if my emotions are, or my stress level is like at a 7 or an 8 or a 9 or a 10. I just have to like cognitively think about it, and then I can know. I found it very helpful, and especially when I was stressed, that as a way to kind of get a feeling of where I'm at. I'm now at the conclusion that it's just a better way to think of whether you're stressed or not. But I don't really think that my emotions are different to other people's in the way that might be suggested by the emotional thermometer. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
It's an interesting one. When it comes to issues of the communication of emotions, I find that for those with Asperger's, their least effective way is talking about it. And sometimes they can convey it by music. Sometimes they can type it rather than talk it. And so the idea of a thermometer is a visual mechanism to indicate the severity of expression by just touching or giving a number of the degree of expression. And so it's just a useful tool to have for someone who may have a difficulty in finding the word, it's alexithymia, to precisely define the emotion. So on that thermometer, you can say, well, it's 6.8 out of a 10-point scale, etc. But what I also find it useful for is for other people to use the thermometer so that the person with Asperger's can understand when they have said or done something what the emotional reaction of other people is, because they may not be able to perceive those subtle qualities.
So you would actually suggest that using that within a relationship, you could just be pointing to that and use that as a way to help understand each other better.
Yeah, it's a two-way process. It's not just the person with Asperger's using the thermometer. It's just that a partner may say, oh, when you said that, I felt happy. Oh, that on my happiness thermometer, that was a 9.6. And the person with Asperger's said, really? Oh, I'll do that again then. or when you said that, that made me feel sad. Oh, but I didn't see it in your body language. Yeah, neurotypicals sometimes hide that. And if you can't see it, you may assume it's not there. So it's a way of improving communication. It's just one of those tools that you can use. But what I find with those with Asperger's is that often by the time the emotion hits them at a cognitive level, it's a very intense emotion that is difficult to control or express. What I'm hoping for the person with Asperger's is to be in touch with the inner feelings at a lower level.
And be really thinking about those more.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I use physiological measures like heart rate. You know, you can get those sports devices that will do that. It's being in tune with your body. And sometimes in Asperger's, there's a division between mind and body. And quite often, the mind overrides the body for intellectual pursuits rather than picking up the internal signals.
Hmm. My feeling is anyway that people on the spectrum are generally living at a much higher level of stress than everyone else anyway.
Undoubtedly. And tragically too. And sometimes the exhaustion from that can lead to such severe depression and suicidal thoughts. And the suicide is, will life get better? And if the view is, no, it won't get better, well, I might as well not be here because I can't stand the pain anymore. So it's the intensity of the emotions. There's a tendency to experience those emotions at a very intense level, but they can come in very quickly, but they can also go very quickly. So in part, it's saying to that person, as much as they possibly can, yes, it's an intense emotion, but can you live with it? Because it will go, and it may go within an hour, and then it's gone. And so it's going through with that individual to recognize that they have those intense emotions, and not to say, what's the matter? Tell me about it. Because that's what neurotypicals do. They alleviate it by talking about it. But that's not the way for those with Asperger's. They've either got to do something that is a thought blocker. The special interest is a thought blocker. It's the off switch. Or it's doing something very physical that burns up the agitation. So it's finding something that works for the individual.
Well, you actually have your patented cure for Asperger's, don't you? It's put the person with Asperger's into their room and close the door, and it's solved.
I say that in jest, but solitude is the cure, because in solitude, you don't have to relate with anyone, so you don't have to worry about social relationships and friendships are being bullied and teased. There's nobody to tease you or nobody to, you know, be unsure of your friendship skills. And you don't have to have any communication skills. You can do what you want to do as long as you like. So the three major diagnostic criteria in the social, communicative, and interest area disappear in solitude. The way I describe Asperger's, when people say, what is Asperger's syndrome? And I say, it is someone who has found something more interesting in life than socializing.
You know, well, maybe you should have been a poet if you weren't doing what you're doing.
Well, I'll be a photographer-poet. Oh, actually, on that topic, we talked a moment ago about the ability to express emotions. I find poetry from people with Asperger's is phenomenally insightful.
Hmm.
And some, it's also writing lyrics for songs. Their biggest difficulty is, tell me about it. Look at me and tell me. And the person is totally overwhelmed and confused. But you can find other ways. Art is another way that the person can express their feelings by a sculpture or a painting. And those are the areas we need to tap into of emotional expression by non-neurotypical means.
Right. Well, do you have many people that end up in acting?
Oh, a lot, yeah. I mean, it's a coping mechanism. It's an ability to recognize, more by the girls and women than the men, or men can do this, and it's one we actually recommend, is if you're not very good at socializing and you're a bit confused, spot somebody who is good. You know, just watch them as another species in a way. How do they move? What do they do? How do they deal with things? Well, do it. Adopt it. Sometimes we'll say, you know, who is a person who could succeed in this situation? Become that person. And those with ASD can be very good at detail, observing and absorbing the persona and movements and actions of someone. And there's a gentleman that I know in his 70s with Asperger's who is a successful theatre actor. And people used to say to him, how do you cope on stage? Because aren't you anxious? Aren't you worried about you'll miss your lines, etc., and you'll destroy the credibility from the audience perspective? He said, no, it's great. It's relaxing because I know what I'm going to say. I know what she's going to say. I know what he's going to say. I know where I'm going to stand. I know the script. I know what's going to occur. I can relax in that situation. But many teenagers with Asperger's say, it's as though I'm in a play. All the other teenagers know the script, know their lines, know the storyline. But I don't have that. And when I give what I think is my line, they laugh at me. But I don't know what I'm supposed to say.
I've heard from friends here in New York on the spectrum that acting is something that's actually helped them improve their social skills a lot.
Oh, yeah. There's an excellent book by Leanne Holiday Willey called Pretending to be Normal. And quite a few of the teenagers don't like being separated from others, saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. But what they will accept, because it's socially acceptable, is drama lessons. So we will then adapt drama as a way of learning how to act when you're bullied and teased, how to act in a social situation, how to develop social chit-chat and so on. Because somebody's watching you, guiding you, you can see it on video, and it's basically learning to act. Now, there is a downside. And the downside for those who do it in real life is that it can be exhausting. And then when they say to people, but I've been diagnosed with Asperger's, others are like, no, of course, no, come on. You can't have Asperger's. You're too good. And because they have done this so well, they're not believed. And there's an excellent YouTube by Maya Tudel from Denmark. And in one in particular, she says that she can socialize very well, she's learned how to act, but then she won't allow people to see the days when she just can't act. She can't put it all together. And it's actually a very powerful YouTube where she's in tears by saying, I can do it, I can fake it, you can give me the Oscar. That gives me a wonderful sense of satisfaction that I can act, but it's not the real me. And some people will say, I can't show the real me, because if I did, would people want to go away from me?
I'll have to go and look for that video. What's the name of Maya?
I think it's MajaToudal. Now, this is going to be text. If you can do a link to Maya Tudel, she's a singer. She has Asperger's syndrome. I met her. She's from Denmark several times. She's a wonderful lady. But her insights on her videos, especially the one when she talks about acting and how exhausting it is powerful. I use it in my clinical training for psychologists.
I'm looking right now.
On YouTube, Maja Tudel.
Yeah, I'll have to look for that later, and maybe I'll email it too. You had an interesting concept. You talk about super NTs.
Yeah.
That's an interesting concept. So do you see a lot of Aspies marrying super NTs?
I call them extreme neurotypicals rather than super NTs. They're a group of people who are very talented in understanding the thoughts, feelings, perspective of others. So they can get into the Aspie mindset. I mean, the way I describe it is like for teachers. Some teachers will say, well, if he hasn't got any friends, he should just try harder. Whereas the extreme neurotypical teacher will say, well, it's not just trying harder. He's actually confused. He needs guidance. So this is where there's an excellent book by Katrine Bentley called Alone Together, where she said with regard to her husband, I saw the heart, not the behavior. I could see why he did what he did. And that's why I fell in love with him. So that's the group I'm talking about there.
I've read that book. He sounds like a nice guy who's dedicated. It also sounds like it could be a tough time for them too.
It is a tough time, well, in part financially, because his income is through the stock market. Being Aspie, he's brilliant at looking at stock market trends, etc. But you know what the stock market's been doing recently? So that is a risk factor in that. But it means that the person with Asperger's, in terms of looking at relationships and so on, it's not only finding a partner, but there's also the issue of when children come along and how to relate to your children as well as how to relate to your partner.
Right. And how do, in your experience, how do Aspies tend to do with that? Because one of the things that shocked me by getting diagnosed and reading about this a little bit is that it's fairly easy to end up hated by your wife and hated by your kids.
Yes, because the person may not understand. I'll go through. First of all, I'll talk about the women with Asperger's. Certainly, in being a mother, one of the difficulties is not maternal skills, but actually having confidence in your maternal intuition. Women with Asperger's can make excellent mothers, but they may not intuitively know that they're good mothers. But the same can go to fathers who may not intuitively know what it is to be a good father. And sometimes in their own childhood, they may not have had good role models in a variety of ways. So it's often a question of understanding the perspective of the children, that your role has now changed, and there are certain expectations in that person's childhood. Just as much as your partner, for example, may need frequent gestures and words of affection, and compliments in particular, the children will too. But compliments for their abilities, not just their intellect, etc. So it's really looking at what do children need, how can you provide that as a father. And what I find in Asperger's is that the person can do it when motivated and given guidance and can be superb at it. But one of the issues is going to be guidance. Where do you get information on that? And that's where I sometimes find that the husbands and fathers with Asperger's tragically feel a failure, that they've not met their partner's expectations. I can't go to the socializing that she wants to do. I can't do all this affection things because I've got so many other responsibilities and things that I've got to do. And I'm a failure in being a partner. And there's a risk of the person with Asperger's feeling that I've let my partner down, my children down, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
And do you have an answer for that?
Well, the answer is there are people who can help you. And it may be a question of checking with your neurotypical partner and saying, I'm not sure here. And what I say sometimes to the family is, look, you are an expert on Microsoft Windows. And if anybody has a Microsoft Windows problem, they'll go to you. But your wife is an expert on kids. And if you've got a problem with kids, go to your wife. She'll guide you. She will know what to do. So it's who to go to. But it's also the literature that you can read on those sorts of things. And it's really improving abilities, communication, and confidence. And sometimes there's an issue that the Aspie parent acts like a magnet to the children. Either the children are very attracted to that person and succeed very well, but others find those characteristics very difficult to cope with and are very antagonistic and provocative to their Asperger parent. So it's really looking at the dynamics of that and understanding the motives of various people and having, in a way, what we would call family therapy, but not based on typical family therapy models, but based on what it's like to have an Aspie parent.
Right.
So in a way, when I talk about that, I say, well, that was me, because my stepfather is an engineer. And a few weeks ago, my mother said to me, we were on a phone call, she said, Anthony, I read a newspaper article about Asperger's syndrome, and Bernard, who's my stepfather, Bernard, that described Bernard to a T. I said, Mother, haven't you actually read my books? Well, I haven't actually read them. They look lovely, but I've never read them. You need to read them. Because I think what happened in a way is that I became bilingual. By being brought up in a household with an Aspie stepfather from the age of 5-6 years old, I speak two languages. I know the Aspie mindset because I've lived within that environment, and that gives me a distinct advantage.
Hmm. What about if someone has an employee who they suspect may be on this spectrum, or a co-worker or something like that? How would you suggest handling that sort of situation?
That's an interesting question, because I can guarantee that those who are reading or listening to this will know someone, not only as a neighbor or somebody they knew at school, but it's quite likely that it's somebody in their workforce that they work with. And there are a number of factors. First of all, don't ridicule, don't reject, try to understand. Give guidance. Now, the chances are that they're going to be exceptionally good at their work, at problem solving, etc., but they can be abrasive to others by being too forthright, not into the teamwork, not into the bonding, not into the group type things. And not to push somebody into areas that they feel uncomfortable with, and giving them a bit of guidance in some of the social situations and what is required. And also making sure that others do not gossip about that person, and acting as their advocate at times to say, well, look, he may not give you much eye contact, but what he's doing is he's looking away to really concentrate on what you're saying. far as he's concerned, he's interested in the problem that you're presenting to him, and he's trying to think of a solution. The fact that he doesn't give you eye contact is irrelevant to solving the problem.
So it would almost be, you're suggesting similar things that we were talking about within personal relationships. You could almost apply some of that in business as well.
Indeed, because those with Asperger's have particular talents. I mean, some of them can be phenomenal entrepreneurs in the information technology area, but I'm not going to go into diagnoses of various famous people. But, in other words, they can have a degree of originality, of single-minded determination, and the ability to be creative in a way that others will say, thinking outside the box, and those with Asperger's will say, well, what box? So, if you look after your Aspies, they can be extraordinarily loyal, helpful, determined. But their downfall may be in the interpersonals, in which case the team or the group of people that they're working with need to understand. But one of the issues that can occur with Asperger's is their difficulty when they're they're promoted or transferred to management. And that's a totally different area to what they may have entered in terms of problem solving, product design, etc. But now they're responsible for a team, and that's office politics, it's egos, it's upsetting people. And I think,
well, that's what you're describing is the Peter principle. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, of being promoted to the state of incompetence. Yes. And that's the problem, because, oh, they're so good, you know, we'll make them in charge of this department. No! They're not going to cope with that, because people are coming to them with their personal problems and they want to solve practical problems.
Right.
So that's where I'm thinking, and there are in fact a few books on this published by Jessica Kingsley Publishers, jkp.com. There are two or three now to help those with Asperger's in management positions, written by Aspies for Aspies, and I think that's a really good idea.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Is there anything you want to discuss that we haven't covered?
Well, time's gone quickly when you're having fun. Anything we haven't covered? I think we've covered a lot of topics. There are other things that we need to explore in the future, the long-term outcome, the aging process and Asperger's syndrome.
We didn't talk about sensory issues.
We didn't talk about sensory issues. Yes, that's a very important one. The new diagnostic criteria at last in DSM-5 will give credibility to that, and hopefully then the research and recognition for that. There's also the movement disturbance, from handwriting skills to problems with ball catching. More of a problem with kids, but there can be the movement issues too. So all those sorts of components, I think, need to be examined in the future, and I'm sure they will be.
Great. Well, Tony, thanks very much for doing the interview.
That's okay, Adrian. Glad to be of help.